Today, after violent clashes in Delhi turned deadly, we look at how Hindu nationalism is dividing India. And, as trade talks are about to begin, the EU lays out its negotiating position.
Early in January, I went to Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi, JNU, as it's called. I met Amir. Amir is a young man. He's a Muslim man. And Amir told me what happened to him on the night of January 5th. Just before 7 in the evening, when the campus is dark and quiet, he had come to this residence hall. As he was standing outside, he looked to his right and he noticed a group of 50 or 60 masked men and women coming towards him. They were carrying sticks and clubs. One of them was swinging a sledgehammer. Amir is scared, so he ran inside the residence hall, ran up to his friend's room, and locked the door with the lights off, hoping that nobody would notice them. He could hear this group of people slamming into rooms. They shattered the glass on the doors. In one case, they threw somebody off a balcony. They beat up a blind kid. This entire attack lasted about half an hour.
This violent attack, taking place at one of India's world-famous universities, shocked the country. But what was perhaps most chilling was who might be responsible.
Amir could see that some of them were members of a campus political group called the Akhil Bharatiya Vidyarthi Parishad.
The group is one of the largest student organisations in India, known by its acronym, the ABVP. It's affiliated to a right-wing Hindu nationalist organisation known as the RSS. And that's significant because of its close ties to the political party that is currently ruling India under the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Outside the gate of the campus, police had gathered. They didn't go into the university to stop these attacks. They stayed outside the university gates to make sure nobody else could go in. The entire night was a night in which a campus political group allied to the party that rules India was allowed to run riot, beat people up, smash property with the active connivance and complicity of the police.
The author and Guardian writer, Samanth Subramanian, believes that this clash of politics at the JNU University mirrors the growing tensions in India more broadly. This is a country led by a Hindu nationalist Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who has pursued increasingly hardline policies since his landslide re-election last year. But the most recent of these policies, the controversial Citizenship Act that many see as elevating Hindus above Muslims, has ignited a massive nationwide backlash. On Monday, as Modi welcomed US President Donald Trump to India, a politician he's been compared to, those protests intensified and then turned deadly.
And here on India Today, we're also keeping close focus on the developments coming in from the national capital, on the violence that broke out in the streets of northeast Delhi.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana.
Four civilians were killed.
Today in focus, what rising Hindu nationalism means for India. Samanth, why did you want to write about this?
It's difficult not to address Modi head on when you're a journalist from India. I feel like Modi sucks all the oxygen out of every discussion in the country in pretty much the same way that Trump does in the US or Brexit does in the UK. But I think more importantly, the mounting pace of Hindu nationalism in India is something that everybody should be worried about. I certainly am, and I so wanted to write about it.
And you've written about this in part through the prism of the Delhi University, the JNU, where that terrible attack happened. It's a place that's known for its secular outlook. There have been protests there against Modi in recent weeks, and the government see the JNU as a symbol of liberal opposition. But that ethos dates right back to when it was set up in 1969. At that time, did that reflect India's politics more broadly?
At the time, I think it did. I think India was founded with this kind of ideal of secular democracy, and that ideal persisted for a long time, just as it did at JNU.
It sounds as if the consensus at the time was very much against the Hindu nationalist group you mentioned, the RSS, and its student wing, the ABVP. But presumably they did exist. What did they stand for?
Well, in JNU, the ABVP was against everything that JNU itself stood for. They believed very firmly in this idea of a Hindu state, and they hated the liberals and the leftists with a passion.
And how active were the two groups?
The RSS itself was active, but it was not politically important. The ABVP, correspondingly, was also quite weak in campus throughout the 70s and 80s. They were practically non-existent. In fact, one of the teachers at JNU today told me that back in the late 80s or the early 90s, if you wanted to attend an ABVP rally, you'd do so with a blanket wrapped around your face, because that's how embarrassing it was to be considered an ABVP supporter.
So when did that start to change?
If we really want to put a date on it, it would be December 1992.
Only rarely in our lives do we witness an event that you can safely say will change the history of our nation.
That was the day a mosque fell and India changed. What happened on December actually had a prelude in 1990. This town called Ayodhya in the state of Uttar Pradesh in northern India had a mosque there for centuries, at least 3.5 centuries. And the Hindu right, the RSS in particular, always claimed that the mosque had been built by an invading king on the birthplace of the Hindu deity Ram. Their agenda here was to knock the mosque down and to build a temple on its spot instead. In late 1990, a senior BJP leader decided he would take out a rally across most of North and Central India to try to raise funds and support for this project. This was a big Toyota truck dressed up as a chariot from Hindu mythology. Funnily enough, the charioteer, the guy who was sitting in the cab of the Toyota, was the Prime Minister of India today, Narendra Modi. Back then, he was just an RSS volunteer. He took this rally out in late 1990. In 1992, in December,
we witness an event that you can
a bunch of RSS and BJP workers from all across India came to Ayodhya and tore down the mosque.
It was at this point that the eyewitness team was attacked by the car sevaks, who were in no mood to allow the demolition to be filmed.
They were able to start translating that into political victories in elections around India. Not coincidentally, the first time the ABVP won a seat on the student union was in 1992, the same year the mosque fell.
Did that then snowball? Did they get more representation on the student union?
Through the 90s, they continued to win more and more seats. In the year 2000, they won the presidency of the student union for the very first time. And again, the events of national politics parallel the events of student politics so neatly, because the BJP formed its first national government in 1996. They ruled right up until 2004.
And why was this happening? Why was there such a rise in Hindu nationalism at this time?
Well, I think there's several factors, and I think a lot of us are still trying to figure it out. It's not coincidental that in the early 1990s, the philosophy and the ideology of socialism itself took a beating. The Soviet Union falls, the left itself is starting to experience weaknesses in its political ideology. And I think as the economy opens up, which it did in the early 90s, India itself discovers the joys and splendors of capitalism and wants to vote for a party that is advocating for more economic reform. In this case, that was the BJP. But secondarily also, I think as India went from being an extremely young nation to sort of a slightly more mature one, it started to crave the kind of presence and stature on the world stage that the BJP promises to provide, that they will develop nuclear weapons and test them, that they will be stronger and more fierce in their responses to Pakistan, the old enemy. And all of these things are tied very much to the BJP's idea of India as a Hindu, strong Hindu nation.
And if we fast forward, Narendra Modi became the chief minister of Gujarat during his period there were controversies over Hindu nationalism. And then in 2014, he became prime minister. Do you think that people who voted for him were doing so because of the Hindu nationalism?
there were a number of people who wanted India to be a Hindu state and continue to want that today. But I think the reasons as to why people voted for the BJP are more complex than that. And there was an element of fatigue with the Congress party, which had been in power for 10 years. The Congress itself had grown corrupt and flabby. It continued to be dominated by a single family.
The Gandhis.
So it was seen as a kind of a dynastic party. And Modi's big selling point, I think, was the fact that he had been chief minister of Gujarat, and he had claimed that he had made the state into a model of what India itself should be, a wealthy, highly industrialized, extremely incorruptible government. You know, all of these promises that he wanted to give for India itself, he trotted out from the Gujarat model.
Regardless of the reasons that people elected Modi, what it resulted in was quite a shift in politics in India. Quite a divisive choice, arguably. I mean, did that start to cause tension in society or tension within families even?
It did. I think it was such a polarizing choice. So the minute Modi came to power, the emboldening and the empowering of a lot of these Hindu right-wing activists and fanatics was clear to see.
A cow brigade horror that took place in Sioni district of the state of Madhya Pradesh. A group of cow vigilantes allegedly brutally thrashed two Muslim men and a woman for allegedly carrying beef.
There were the series of beef lynchings, as they're called. These gangs of vigilantes who claim to want to protect the cow and beef, which are both sacred in Hinduism. And so they would target Muslims and lower caste Hindus who were even suspected of smuggling a cow. That kind of violence shook the country.
This is the new India, which Prime Minister Modi termed as inclusive.
There were shootings of writers and activists. Most notably, Gauri Lankesh, a journalist in Bangalore, was shot outside her house.
8 hours after the murder of journalist Gauri Lankesh, there is
by a gang of right-wing Hindu fanatics.
Is India being overtaken by hate? That's what we're talking about tonight.
You've already talked a couple of times about how the national picture was often mirrored within universities, within the JNU in Delhi. Was that happening at this time?
I mean, the most striking example of that is what happened in February 2016. A man had just been hanged. This was a Kashmiri man who was suspected of being a terrorist. And there was a protest rally in JNU decrying capital punishment in general, but this hanging in particular. The protest rally was led by the head of the student union at the time, a man named Kanhaiya Kumar. Kanhaiya Kumar was subsequently arrested and charged with sedition, which is an old colonial law that still, for some reason, exists on the books in India.
Sedition for holding a protest?
Sedition for holding a protest, because you're protesting the act of the nation. You're protesting the nation's decision to execute a man. So Kanhaiya was arrested. He spends a few days in jail. He's taken to a courthouse in Delhi, where...
In the court this morning, those are images of Kanhaiya Kumar there being roughed up as he was taken into court.
In the grounds of the courthouse, just outside the courthouse, he's beaten up by a mob that includes at least one BJP legislator, that includes several lawyers who are partial to the BJP, and the police are standing by and doing nothing. Journalists are beaten up at the same time as well.
They've asked for the courtroom to be evacuated after scenes of utter lawlessness, chaos and mayhem.
And I think that was a particularly vivid example of how far the state would go and the BJP would go to protect the people that it wanted to protect and to allow harm to come to people who opposed it.
I mean, why would a government see a liberal university in Delhi as the kind of symbol of its opposition?
But this is the nature of authoritarian governments, is that they see every single shred of opposition, every spark of opposition, as something that has to be stamped down and put out before it flares.
That sounds like a very worrying shift towards more of an authoritarian model of government during that first term when Modi was prime minister. Were there policies during that period that also marked a shift towards more forthright Hindu nationalism?
The most prominent one, I think, would be this exercise called the National Register of Citizens that started in Assam a few years ago. Assam is a particularly fraught northeastern state. It's on the border with Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a Muslim-majority country, and the border has been relatively porous for decades. And so one of the planks of the BJP's ideology has always been to get rid of illegal Muslim immigrants from Bangladesh in Assam. And the way they want to do this is, of course, to ask people to provide elaborate documentation of their fathers or their grandfathers living in India before 1971. That's not always possible. Assam is full of poor people. Documentation is sparse.
Fresh nervousness in families where some relatives have been kept out of the new citizen list.
And inevitably, of course, when it was completed in Assam, people discovered that 9 out of 10 cases that were adjudicated had to do with Muslims. And these were the people who were denied citizenship. There are detention centers being built in Assam now to house these so-called illegal immigrants. So you have this situation where very methodically these Muslims in Assam are being siphoned out of the population, being sent to these detention centers, stripped of their citizenship and voting rights. That is, in my opinion, a really sort of big step forward in this idea to create a Hindu state.
So what is the ultimate aim for the BJP? What does achieving a Hindu state mean?
Logistically speaking, it would be very difficult for the BJP to imagine India as exclusively Hindu, because what do you do with 180 or 200 million minorities? So I think what they would actually see is a kind of a country with a graded citizenship system where Hindus enjoy more rights and more privileges than anyone else.
And interestingly, you began by suggesting that in 2014, it wasn't clear whether the votes he got were driven because people supported his Hindu nationalism or whether that there was a certain level of fatigue with the systems that had been in place before. It feels to me that by 2019, the direction of travel was very clear. So why did he then go on to get an even bigger majority?
I'm still struggling to answer that for myself. I mean, one possible theory is that the opposition, the Congress, is still so weak and withered that it's very difficult to find anybody who wants to vote for it. But I did have a moment of serious sort of moral doubt that I started to actively wonder whether there are that many people in India, including people I know, who want India to be a Hindu state. It's not a majority, mind you, because India has a Westminster-style democracy. But even for 35% of the population to want India to be exclusively Hindu is a frightening prospect.
Okay, so Modi did win a bigger majority in 2019. What policies has he pursued since then? And do they mark a further shift towards a nationalist agenda?
The pace of how quickly he sort of started rolling out items on the BJP wish list has sped up more than I would have imagined.
A sudden and momentous decision.
The first major thing that happened was the suspension of a constitutional provision that grants Kashmir sort of a special status within the Indian Union.
It's a change in the constitution with far-reaching consequences.
Not long after that, the Supreme Court in India, which is increasingly being seen as malleable, released this judgment.
Now, India's top court has ruled that a disputed religious site be given to Hindus for the construction of a temple.
Where they said it was illegal for that mosque in Ayodhya to be torn down. But despite that, there should still be a temple built on that site, which again seemed to be seen as a vindication and a win for the RSS. There was the promise that the National Register of Citizens, the exercise that was carried out in Assam, would be rolled out across India to every single state. And then, of course, in early December, you had the Citizenship Act.
Tell me about the Citizenship Act. How does it work?
The Act promises to fast-track the citizenship applications of refugees fleeing persecution in three neighboring countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. And it fast-tracks the application of every single minority group except Muslims.
What was the reaction?
There were protests that greeted it from the very first day. And this was heartening for somebody like me or for other liberals, because as the Kashmir provision was suspended, as the National Register of Citizens was promised across the country, as the Supreme Court verdict on the temple and the mosque came out, we had seen no protests anywhere. And it was disheartening because it seemed to confirm, for me at least, it seemed to confirm the suspicion that there are actually millions of people in India, hundreds of millions of people in India, who actually do subscribe to this idea of a Hindu state. So when the protest started after the Citizenship Act, that was sort of the first bright spark of light and hope that I'd seen in a long time.
Why do you think it triggered such a big backlash this time?
I think the feeling is that in 7.5 decades as a free country, India has never faced a more momentous crisis. There's something unique about the Citizenship Act in terms of how it sets out explicitly to destroy the constitutional vision of India, which is the vision for a liberal secular democracy. The Citizenship Act works in tandem with the National Register of Citizens. Suddenly, people are afraid that they're going to have to prove their citizenship. It allows possibilities for rent-seeking, for harassment, for corruption. It really holds out this threat that you might be declared illegal. And I think that was what stimulated and sustained the season of protests. That, of course, in midwinter in these protests, we get the attacks on JNU.
Were those attacks a sign that people on the right, that Hindu nationalists, felt that this was a huge threat to them?
The severity and the strength and the length of the protests unsettled everybody in the Hindu right, I think. They hadn't expected, certainly, protests to go on for this long. And the fact that it was not just Muslims out there protesting, it was Hindus and everybody else, I think that was a clear sign that something was wrong.
One of the most striking things about the JNU attack was the way the police simply failed to act. Is that something that's happening more broadly?
It kind of characterized the government's response to the entire season of protests. The minute they started to realize that these protests were happening, they started to detain and arrest people without reason. They would shut down the internet for parts of the day to make sure that people couldn't coordinate on WhatsApp over where to meet and protest. In Uttar Pradesh, in the state of Uttar Pradesh, police went into homes and wrecked them and beat people up. In Delhi, there was another university called Jamia Millia University, and there were attacks by the police on the students there as well.
What is the government hoping to achieve?
Eventually, the protests will just die down and they will plow forward with the implementation of the Register of Citizens and the Citizenship Act. I mean, the Home Minister has already said that there's no way the government is going to roll any of this stuff back. So the protests haven't affected the government's resolve to stick with this policy.
Have the protests affected India's resolve to stick with the BJP?
That remains to be seen. But I mean, we did see an election in Delhi a couple of days ago in which the BJP won just 7 out of 70 seats. That's not something the BJP is used to at all, to lose that badly. Of course, there are many other factors that play into this Delhi election. But I think the fact that these protests have really shaken the nation, I think that has some small part to play.
And since that, are the protests still going strong across the country?
They are. I mean, particularly in Delhi, the heart of all this resistance, I mean, the protest is still going strong. Sometimes these gatherings swell to tens of thousands. It's a wide cross-section of society. This is a real resistance.
Reporting on this, taking us right into the heart of the JNU and this kind of tussle that there's been between the government and between this university, what did you take away from it?
Well, I think personally for me, the most important thing was to be able to see any resistance at all, because I think it kind of characterizes where India will go over the next few years. The BJP still has 4.5 years in power. They may win another national election after that. So they're still a strong party. But the success of their policies has to be gauged on the kind of resistance that it meets within Indian civil society at large. And I think these protests were finally an indicator that there will be sections of society that stand up to this idea of a Hindu state.
Samant, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Samant Subramanian, who has written an excellent long read on this at theguardian.com. Coming up, the EU lays out its trade talk demands.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes and fears when it comes to something called gene editing.
I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app.
Now, if you thought Brexit was over, buckle up, as at least a year's worth of negotiations over the UK's future trading relationship with Brussels are about to begin. On Tuesday, the EU laid out its tough opening position that, regardless of its global ambitions, the UK must not undercut the bloc in its goods and services. We caught up with The Guardian's Brussels Bureau Chief Daniel Boffey in the wake of the announcement.
4 years since the Brexit referendum, and the EU have issued their negotiating mandate for the future relationship. We thought the withdrawal agreement talks were tough. This is going to be even harder. The European Union's offering an unprecedented deal, so a zero tariff, zero quotas on goods traded between the UK and the EU, so reducing the costs of trade. And no other country has such a deal for all goods anywhere in the world. But the European Union don't want the United Kingdom to lower their environmental, workers or social standards, because they'll be able to undercut French or German businesses when they sell into the European market. But they want to go further, in fact. They want to say to the UK, well, as we develop our rules and regulations, as they improve over time, for example, if our environmental standards might improve, you should follow us. And if you don't follow us, then we'll be able to take trade remedies. So there's no way that you can undercut us. On state aid, it's slightly different. Those are the rules that decide what subsidies are allowed for industry, for tech, for farmers. And on that, the European Union is saying, no, you have to follow us completely. You have to essentially incorporate dynamically, as we change it, state aid law. And that's extremely problematic, because the United Kingdom's position is that we want a free trade deal with the European Union, but we don't expect you to set us rules and expect us to incorporate your regulations into our law book. A late addition agreed by the 27 now European Union member states was a little clause which said that the UK should stay in line with EU regulations in terms of the health and sanitary rules with regard to animal and agricultural products. And this essentially is an attempt to say that the UK should continue to ban chlorinated chicken, possibly even genetically modified food, certain pesticides. And the idea behind this is that European meat producers, they want to continue to sell their meat into the UK, and they don't want to face cheaper chicken, for example, that's been chlorine washed. They want to continue the very fruitful sale of their products into the UK. Boris Johnson's position on the trade talks is actually very clear cut. He simply wants a loose relationship from the European Union. Yes, selling goods on a zero tariff basis. And yes, recognising that the UK we'll need to sign up to some provisions to make sure that there's a level playing field, but absolutely not following EU rules at all. Meanwhile, Johnson wants to have parallel talks with Donald Trump's White House over a trade deal with the US. The problem is that we'll have to accept US products into our market as part of any trade deal, which are made by a different standard. That's a problem for farmers and for our businesses, because they'll be undercut by US standards. So the National Farmers Union are very concerned about that. And they're very concerned that if we don't have a deal with the European Union by the end of 2020, then huge tariffs will be put on British meat producers, for example, who want to sell into the European market. Ultimately, the reality is that you make goods to one particular standard, you're unlikely to make goods to different standards, and there are huge costs if you open your market to people who have lower standards than you.
That was Daniel Boffey. Do follow this story all the way up to December on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Samantha Subramanian and Daniel Boffey. This episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.